All right, so now we have moved over from Old Testament eschatology into New Testament eschatology. The principal passage is Matthew chapter 24. This is called the Olivet Discourse, because Jesus gave this from Mount Olivet, the Mount of Olives. We're going to be reading tonight from Matthew 24. Mark's version, the Markan version in Mark 13, is basically like Matthew 24 light. Luke's version, we're going to compare and contrast. So these are the two different versions, which are significantly different in my estimation. But let's start with Matthew 24 as a base, and then we'll flip over to Luke and see what we can do. Matthew 24, verse 1. Jesus came out of the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. If you remember the context for this, Matthew 23, Jesus just gave an excoriating rebuke against the Pharisees, scribes, and other religious leaders. And at the end of that chapter, we read this, Matthew 23:38. Look, your house is left to you desolate, which all commentators would agree, your house refers to the temple. Your house has become desolate. For I tell you the truth, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Psalm 118, we've seen that before, haven't we? Matthew 21, when Jesus was giving his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, they were saying precisely this, singing this psalm, Psalm 118. Preterists have a very difficult time with this passage. You will not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. How do they deal with that? Well, they say the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, verse 38, that happened in 70 AD, with which we would agree. That's what he's talking about, their temple. But what about this part? You will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So under a full or partial preterist view, they believed that the coming of Jesus was in 70 AD, where just like in the Old Testament judgments, Yahweh would appear in a cloud over Jerusalem or over the neighboring nations, and he would come and judge. Psalm 104, Isaiah 19. And so too, Jesus came in a metaphorical sense via the Roman armies to destroy Jerusalem. So are we to believe that as the Romans for 3.5-4 years from AD 66 to 70 finally broke through in the Jewish war in AD 70 into the temple, and they're stabbing and burning and raping and pillaging and destroying the Jewish people, are we to believe that those Jewish people and religious leaders were singing, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord? That's what they would have to believe. Unless, on a futurist perspective, you believe that this is referring to a future period when Jesus comes back at his second coming at the end of human history, and it's at that point that the Jewish people come together and welcome their Messiah. Think of Romans 11. Think of Luke 21. Think of, well, numerous passages, Zechariah 12 through 14, where the Jewish people, they see Messiah, they look on him whom they have pierced, and they do sing, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Well, that's just a little aside. Here's the Mount of Olives. And so Jesus would have been looking at the temple westward as he's giving this discourse in Matthew 24. Here's a little video from the Mount of Olives, and you can see as they scan over, I kind of slowed this down here so it doesn't go too quick. Looking westward from the Mount of Olives, you'd have a really nice view of the temple. There's the Dome of the Rock. There's the Jewish temple. So he would not have been that far. And he's looking at this event. Josephus, who is a first century Roman Jewish historian, the story with Josephus is that he was a Pharisee, he was a thoroughly Jewish man, but at Masada, when the Romans came through and killed all the Jewish men, Josephus somehow escaped, basically surrendered to the Romans, escaped a death, I should say, one way from the Romans. Josephus escaped death and then surrendered to the Romans and basically became a historian for the Roman Empire. We read in Antiquities of the Jews, which is his book, book 15, he says the stones of Jerusalem, this temple, were 40 feet long. How far would that be? 10 basketball hoops. That would be like from here to that window. 18 feet deep. So about from here to the wall. And then 12 foot tall. So I'm a little over 6 footer. So twice the size of me. That's how big these stones were of the temple. The temple, he says, was covered all over with plates of gold of great weight, and at the first rising of the sun, reflected back a fiery, very fiery splendor. He talks about how when the sun would hit the temple, it just, you couldn't even look at it. Tacitus, who is an early 2nd century AD historian, he called the temple, quote, immensely opulent. Coming from a Roman, that's saying quite a bit. Looking at the Jewish temple was just incredibly opulent. The Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, Baba Batra 4a, says, he who has not seen the temple of Herod has not seen a beautiful thing. This was a gorgeous, gorgeous religious temple. It was enormous. It was covered in gold. And Jesus said to them, as they're pointing out these temple buildings, he says, do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down. Think about that. Imagine what that would be like. You're looking at this beautiful, enormous, gorgeous, rich, opulent temple, and Jesus is saying, you see all these stones? 40 foot long, 18 foot wide, 12 feet tall. There won't be a single stone left upon another. This thing is going to be completely razed to the ground. Josephus records in his book, The Jewish War, he says, it was so thoroughly laid, even with the ground, that there was left nothing to make those that came near believe that it had ever been inhabited. This was fulfilled, exactly as Jesus predicted. The second temple was so thoroughly destroyed, you couldn't even tell it was there. The Romans ripped it apart, limb from limb. Today, when you visit Israel and you go to the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, that is the outer wall. It's like an encampment wall that Herod had built. That's not part of the temple. That is the encasing encampment wall. There's no temple there to this day. Well, this hit like an atomic bomb for these disciples. They're sitting there thinking, what in the heck is he talking about? To hear that the Jewish temple would be destroyed to that level would be like hearing from a modern day psychic or prophet that Washington, D.C. is going to be destroyed, Moscow, you know, the White House, New York City, those are all going to be laid to the ground. You'd be thinking, well, that's got to be the end of the world. So as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, and they asked him three questions. They asked, number one, tell us when these things will happen, the destruction of the second temple. Number two, what will be the sign of your coming? And number three, what will be the sign of the end of the age? Now, to the disciples, they thought that all three of these questions had the same referent, the same answer. The destruction of the second temple must be, on their view, the end of the world, the sign of Jesus' coming, the end of the age. They assumed that at least, at the very least, these events would be simultaneous. Of course, preterists argue in the main, that's exactly how this was fulfilled. Everything was fulfilled in AD 70. Destruction of the temple, the coming of Christ, the so-called end of the age. The age of humans? No, the age of the old covenant. Think about 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11. These things have happened upon whom the end of the ages has come. That's their view. I'm going to argue that these three questions, these are coming from the lips of the disciples. But Jesus is not going to answer these the way that they expected. These events happen at a different time and in a different order. So let's look at this first question. Tell us, when will these things happen? Well, Matthew doesn't record this. Matthew does record that Jesus predicts the destruction of the second temple, but he doesn't predict when this is going to happen. Luke, however, the gospel according to Luke, which Matthew is more for the Jews, Luke is more for the Gentiles, written by a Gentile, he goes into this description of the destruction of the second temple by the Romans, the Gentile nations. Let's start in Luke chapter 21, verse 7. They questioned him, saying, Teacher, When therefore will these things happen, and what will be the sign when these things are about to take place? Matthew 24:3 says, when will these things happen? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Do you see a difference between those two set of questions? In the Lucan version, we read, when are these things going to happen, the destruction of the temple, and when they are going to take place? In Matthew's version, it's talking about the sign of his coming, the end of the age. Those are two different questions going on here. This would be a case of telescoping, where one gospel author is focusing on one part of this discourse while the other is focusing on another. Of course, we know Jesus' sermons weren't 5 minutes long. That's all the longer it takes to read Matthew 24. This must have been an extended discussion. So Luke chooses to focus on this portion. All right, and he said to them, see to it that you are not misled, for many will come in my name, saying, I am he, and the time is near. Many people are going to try to say, I'm the Messiah. Do not go after them. Now, Josephus records many examples of false prophets leading up to the time of AD 70. Read his Antiquities of the Jews, the Jewish War. This could be a first century fulfillment. This part is open to debate, especially in Luke's version. Don't go after these false prophets. We also read, when you hear of wars and disturbances, don't be terrified, for these things must take place first, but the end does not follow immediately. So he seems to be saying here, there's going to be wars, but the end, okay, this isn't over with. We read in verse 10, then he continued by saying to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes and in various places, plagues and famines. There will be, there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. Now think about that for a second. Great earthquakes. Can we think of any earthquakes which occurred in the first century? Even if you're a Bible reader, you know that there were earthquakes. Think about when Paul gets loosed from prison, Acts 16. This could be a first century fulfillment. What about plagues? What about famines? Do we know about famines? Bible readers will say, even if you just knew the Bible, think about Acts 18 and, or rather, Acts chapter 11, where Agabus predicts that terrible famine which is going to strike Jerusalem. So there was famines. This could have been first century fulfillment. And there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. Well, we never saw that happen. On the other hand, Josephus records that during this Jewish war, that there was a star, or perhaps a comet, depending on how his words are rendered, that stood over the city of Jerusalem for a full year during the destruction. In ancient times, these astrological, astronomical signs during times of war were bad omens. And so from this, Josephus and others have inferred that this was a sign of God's judgment. But before all these things, they will lay their hands on you and will persecute you, delivering you to the synagogues and prisons, bringing you before kings and governors for my name's sake. This could be first century persecution. It will lead to an opportunity for your testimony. We've definitely seen that in the New Testament. So make up your minds not to prepare beforehand to defend yourselves, for I will give you utterance and wisdom which none of your opponents will be able to resist or refute. But you will be betrayed, even by parents and brothers and relatives and even friends, and they will put some of you to death, and you will be hated by all because of my name. This could be first century fulfillment. This is what happened to the apostles, Jesus' disciples. Yet not a hair of your head will perish. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. So what is this saying here? Not a hair of your head will perish. This could be referring to physical protection. That's one interpretation, that God is going to protect them, so to speak. It could also refer to spiritual protection. So this would be very commensurate with the Calvinistic teaching of perseverance of the saints. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. If you're faithful to the end, you'll be not sent to hell. Not a hair of your head will perish. How do we interpret this? Let's look at the context. Luke 21:20, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. So which is it? Is it spiritual protection, physical protection? It seems to me that he's talking about physical protection if you follow his advice in verses 20 and following. This was fulfilled in AD 66 by Cestius Gallus, who was a Roman who was invading Jerusalem. You see, the zealot party in Israel, in the tradition of the Maccabees, trying to kick out these evil pagan Gentile dogs, the Romans, had started a revolt in Jerusalem, and the zealot party, kind of like terrorists, were trying to use guerrilla warfare and kick the Romans out of Jerusalem. Well, Rome found out about this. They sent in legion upon legion to just completely eviscerate Jerusalem. The Roman governor of Syria sent 30,000 troops right in there to pacify Jerusalem, won several victories before reaching Jerusalem, so he's moving his way through Judea, 30,000 troops, and then he laid siege of Jerusalem for over a week, about 9 days. So let's look back at verse 20 again. Jesus says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then you will know her desolation is near. He doesn't say when you see the city surrounded by armies that they're dead. It's coming close. Laying siege for 9 days. Here's Josephus again from the Wars of the Jews, Jewish Wars. He says, Cestius, had he but continued the siege a little longer, would have certainly taken the city. Remember, he had 30,000 troops around the city for 9 days, but he was hindered from putting an end to the war that very day. If he had just sieged it and then continued on, that would have been the end of the Jewish war. The uprising would have been quelled, would have been fine. Josephus says, it then happened that Cestius recalled his soldiers from the place. He retired from the city without any reason in the world. What a strange observation from Josephus. So Cestius has him outpowered, outflanked, sieged, could have won, and then all of a sudden he just pulls out. What do we do with that? Well, let's look here. In AD 66, Cestius leaves Jerusalem, and when he stops this siege, based on Luke 21:20 and following, the Christians flee Jerusalem. When you see Jerusalem surrounded, he's going to argue, run. By the time of AD 70, Titus comes in, and Titus was not messing around. He comes in, legion upon legion, wipes out Jerusalem. Josephus puts the number of the dead at over a million, 1.1 million. The Christians here in Jerusalem, following the words of Jesus in Luke 21, flee up north to Pella. So they get out. Their Jewish friends, their Jewish neighbors considered them to be cowards at the time. Because here we go, we fought off the Romans, Cestius left, we've got our city, we're holding it under control, just like the Maccabean era, and all of a sudden these Jewish Christians are fleeing to Pella, and they're thinking these guys are cowards. And yet we read in Luke 21:21, when you see the city surrounded, Cestius, AD 66, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are even in the country must not enter the city. How many different ways is that saying, get out of there? This is the end of the world for Jerusalem. Eusebius states this, the people of the church in Jerusalem had been commanded by a revelation to leave the city and to dwell in Pella. What revelation could that refer to? Luke 21. They read their Bible. They had their Bible. They knew we got to get out of here, which is an interesting concept when you think about it. For those critics who late date the Gospel of Luke and Matthew and Mark because, oh, there's no way Jesus could have predicted the destruction of the temple because that would be like predictive prophecy. And yet Eusebius teaches here that these very Christians read the prophecy and knew now's the time to flee. Epiphanius, who's a 4th century Christian historian, he says the Nazarene sect exists in Berea, Pella, and in Bashan. That is where the sect began when all the disciples were living in Pella after they moved from Jerusalem, since Christ told them to leave Jerusalem and withdraw because it was about to be besieged. Now, that wouldn't make any sense. Well, we'll compare that once we get to Matthew 24, but I'm not getting ahead of myself. Verse 22. So Jesus tells them, when you see it surrounded, get out. Because, he says, these are the days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Here he's probably referring to Daniel 9:26, the destruction of the second temple. This could also be referring to the teaching from Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 and 29, the blessings and curses. If you follow the covenant, you'll be blessed. If you break it, you'll be cursed, something like that. He says in Luke 21:23, woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be a great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. Great distress upon the land. Let's compare that with Matthew 24. So far, I'd like to argue that Luke 21, this is first century. So far, everything he's described is consistent with the first century destruction of Jerusalem. But when we compare it with Matthew 24, we see several critical differences. In Matthew 24, we see that they're commanded to leave Jerusalem after seeing the abomination of desolation. Now, I'd like you to think about that for a second. Do you know what happens at the abomination of desolation? This is where Titus, after sieging the city for 3 years, marches into Jerusalem, marches into the temple, kicks down the door, levels it to the ground, plunders all the gold, pilfers all the sacred objects. That's the abomination of desolation. At that point in AD 70, guess how many people were dead? Over 1 million. So Jesus is saying, yeah, you guys should leave after you see the abomination of desolation. You know what that would be like? A psychic saying to somebody in Japan in 1945, you should flee Hiroshima, Nagasaki, when you see the mushroom cloud. At that point, it's too late. You're dead. To say, flee the city after you see the abomination of desolation, too late to obey that command because everybody is a mass of flesh and blood. They've already died. Okay, Luke 21 says that there's a great distress over the land. That would be Israel. I don't see any reason to see a future end of history prediction there. However, in Matthew 24:21, we read a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. That language is simply inconsistent with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. There's just no way around that. First of all, this was not the worst horrific suffering that the world had ever seen up until that point. It was awful. It was brutal. It was savage. I'll tell you what, it's not the worst suffering and everything else that has happened since then, even to the Jewish people. Think of the Holocaust. Think of the Great World Wars. Since the beginning of the world until now, that can't be referring to Israel. This has got to be referring to human history. Jesus goes so far as to say, unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. No life at all. Luke is even more particular. Luke 21:35, when he does flash forward into future history, he refers to judgment coming on all those who live on the face of the earth. That's what we call universal global judgment. Not just a great distress for the land. We read in verse 24, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations. That would be AD 70. That's what happened. Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles, as it turns out, the Romans, until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So who are the Gentiles here? The Romans take over Jerusalem. And he says that they're going to rule and reign until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, which implies that the times of the Gentiles at some point will be over, at which point the Jewish people will be brought back into their land. And so this would be an implicit, nearing an explicit prediction by Jesus that at the end of history, the Jewish people will come back and reclaim Jerusalem. Here is where I see a gap, verse 25. One of the reasons is this word until, the times of the Gentiles. We've witnessed this. Jerusalem, Israel hasn't been a nation. Gentiles have been ruling. The Jewish people have been spread, led captive into many nations. Once we get to verse 25, Jesus says, there will be signs in sun, moon, and stars, and on the earth, dismay among the nations, and perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting from fear and the expectation of the things which are coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Again, the first part, up until verse 24, seems perfectly consistent with the Jewish war of AD 70. This part, I mean, read it for yourself. I don't know how you can square that with something that's already happened. The powers of the heavens will be shaken. This part, definitely not. They will see the coming of the Son of Man in a cloud with power and great glory. But when these things begin to take place, straighten up, lift up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near. And so this would be a case of a gap in prophecy. Let's flip back to Matthew. So Luke gives us the answer to the first question. When will these things happen? Presumably in Matthew's account, Matthew says, I already told you. Your house will be left to you desolate. Not one stone will be left upon another. Well, now he moves forward into these next two questions. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Matthew 28:20, Jesus says, behold, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Can this be referring to a first century fulfillment? Not a chance. Unless you're saying that the end of the age was in AD 70, and so Jesus is no longer with us. We're on our own. Unless you think the Great Commission is obsolete, which is the place from which this passage is taken. The end of the age, according to Matthew, is the end of the age, the end of human history. Well, Jesus goes on to answer this. He says, see to it that no one misleads you. So we see some similarity with Luke 21. For many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. Sounds like Luke 21. You will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See to it that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not the end. The end of what? The end of the age. All of these signs Matthew is going to go through, they're different in the sense that he's not trying to predict the destruction of the temple. He's not trying to make predictions here. Whatever he says here, he keeps saying, but that's not the end. So they're thinking, destruction of the temple, that's got to be the end of the world. And Jesus is like, no, wars, rumors of wars. He says, for nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. In various places, there will be famines and earthquakes. I mean, as we look over at history, we discover that global deaths and conflicts have arisen, that's for sure. These are mapped out here in this infographic to show some of the bigger events. And as history has continued, we see that wars, deaths have become worse. Second World War, genocide of the Jews, etc. What about famines? He mentions famines. This could be that this is going to get worse, progressively worse. Revelation 6:6, referring to the same era. Revelation 6 seems to be like the signs of the times as well. Wish we had time to exposit Revelation 6, but here we read, 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wages and 6 pounds of barley for a day's wages, and don't damage the oil and the wine, for goodness sakes. What is the saying here? 2 pounds of wheat for a day's wage? This much wheat, 2 pounds of wheat, could feed a grown man for one day, according to Herodotus. Or, to put it closer to Roman times, this would be, according to Cicero, about 8 to 16 times the average price of 2 pounds of wheat or 6 pounds of barley. So what's this communicating? This is communicating famine. For a grown man to work a hard day's work and to earn enough money just to feed yourself, that would be absolute destitution. You wouldn't be able to have a house. You wouldn't be able to have clothes. You wouldn't be able to have a family, provide for anyone else. And so these would be famines. That's what this is referring to. Let's read from an authority in this area, Richard Heinberg. This is from his book, The End of Growth, from 2011. He says, demand for food is slowly outstripping supply. Food producers' ability to meet growing needs is increasingly being strained by rising human populations. Falling freshwater supplies, the rise of biofuels industries, expanding markets within industrialized nations, for more resource-intensive meat and fish-based diets, dwindling fisheries, and climate instability. The result will almost inevitably be a worldwide food crisis sometime in the next 2 or 3 decades. This would fit with what Jesus is predicting, that no, we're not going to reach to a state of utopia where everything is fixed. He's saying plagues are going to get worse. Earthquakes are going to get worse. World wars are going to get worse. John Beddington, chief science advisor to the United Kingdom government, he says this, by 2030, we are going to need 50% more food, 40% more available fresh water, and something on the order of 50% more low-carbon energy. We need a radical redesign of global food systems. Put this in perspective, 70% of our fresh water is for the purpose of irrigation. If we need more fresh water just to drink, we also need most of it to grow our food. And so famines, yeah, that's putting us in a bad place. Revelation 6:8, a couple verses later, he predicts that many will die by plagues, which to an ancient person you could see that would be something with which you'd be especially paranoid. Plagues, you didn't know about bacteria, you didn't know about influenza, viruses of any kind, you just saw people get sick, drop over dead. And so many believe this is the writing, the mindset of a first century man writing a work of apocalyptic literature. And yet, 20 centuries later, in the height of modernity, plagues are still terrifying to us. Joshua Lederberg, who is a Nobel Prize winner, molecular biologist, he says the single biggest threat to man's continued dominance on the planet is a virus. A little virus. We keep thinking, oh, we're getting ahead of this. I mean, to a large degree, we have. Vaccinations for those smart enough to take them. We finally have a vaccination for polio, and people are refusing to take it because of pseudoscience and nonsense, craziness. So we've been able to break free to a large degree, and yet, at the same time, these viruses, bacteria, they're evolving at such incredible rates. I mean, part of evolution, the science of evolution, is having a big population size. It's population genetics. And the bigger the population and the more generations you can get, the more opportunity you have for genetic diversity and Darwinism. You know, killing flies with DDT, they have a big population. They have a very quick turnover in generations, and so there's more mutation, more selection. And so we see examples of Darwinism in that way. Well, viruses make the population sizes of flies look like, you know, kiddie pools. I mean, they're like, viruses are like, you know, how many viruses do you have in your body? Billions, trillions of them. Big population, lots of generations, lots of mutations. So we're throwing medicine, we're throwing antibiotics at bacteria. And these bacteria, these viruses are mutating like crazy. Let's see, Mattson and Pavlis, this is from Scientific American 2010. Humankind is more vulnerable than ever to a devastating Black Death-style pandemic. More vulnerable than ever, they say. They place the odds at 50-50 in the next 30 years that we're going to have something like the Black Death. The scary thing is, really scary, is that back when the Black Death occurred in Europe and in parts of China, I mean, there was a sense in which population sizes were quarantined just because you had to get there by horse. And if you have the Black Death, you're not going to be crossing hundreds of miles. Today, you hop in an airplane now, you're in China in 20 hours. And so this could very quickly spread. There's no way we could stop it. We could retard the spread of a virus or something, but we couldn't stop it, that's for sure. McKenna from Scientific American 2011 says many lethal infections that antibiotics have held at bay for decades might soon return with a vengeance. For almost every antibiotic developed to date, bacteria have evolved a resistance factor that protects them from the drug's attack. For almost every resistance factor, pharmaceutical companies have produced a tougher drug. Until now. Over the decades, the battle has gradually tilted to the side of the organisms, like a seesaw, slowly shifting out of balance. Bacteria, after all, have evolution on their side. It takes them 20 minutes to produce a new generation. That's so true. Many of these infections and bacteria, I mean, the generation, you got a new mutation that quickly. She writes, it takes a decade or more to research and develop a new drug. We can't keep up. I mean, it used to be penicillin. They found penicillin. They're like, that's the miracle drug. It works for everything. It fixes you. All of a sudden, we had all of these strains which were resistant to penicillin, antibiotics. And so then they got into vancomycin. I don't even know what they're on now. I mean, we can't keep up at this point. Now what they're doing is using a cocktail of antibiotics on people, where if, you know, penicillin wipes out 99% of the bacteria and vancomycin knocks out 99.9%, they're kind of hoping that that overlap will wipe out the bacteria. The problem is this is a prime environment scenario for evolution to take place. Big populations of disease, rapid generations, rapid mutation, incredible selective pressure. And authorities in this area are scared to death that we're producing the superflu. We're producing the next bacteria that's going to wipe us out. To put this in perspective, the infamous H1N1 virus of 1918 killed between 50 to 100 million people in a span of 2 years. They didn't even know what this was. They were just seeing people falling over dead, one after another. And so authorities wonder, really, could this be referring to the future? Jesus seems to be saying these are precursors. He doesn't say that this is the end. Earthquakes, natural disasters, these are up, that's for sure. This is from MDAT. This is the International Disaster Database. How'd you like to work for them? Secular Research Organization, Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters. Look at the number of disasters since 1900. Okay, way up, way more. Look at the total deaths. Oh, interesting. More back at the beginning of the 20th century compared to the second part. So we have more disasters today, less deaths. How could that be the case? Well, presumably because we're getting better at building architecture, better codes. One of the differences we saw between the earthquakes in Japan versus the earthquakes in South American, Latin American country by the name of Haiti, thank you, is that the building architectural codes in Japan were way, way ahead of those in Haiti. The codes in Haiti, those buildings fell apart when that earthquake hit, just crumbled. And so we're actually seeing less deaths today. So there you go. It's disproving what Jesus said. No, Jesus said there would be more earthquakes. He didn't say there'd be more deaths. Kind of interesting to think about. Now, the total number of people affected, total affected persons reported, way higher. Really in the last 30 years, we've seen just a skyrocketing of natural disasters. Total damage scaled. Now, this would be scaled. So it's playing fair to U.S. dollars in 2014. Obviously, inflation has increased since 1960. But if you scale for inflation, the money that we're spending on these natural disasters, way more than ever before. What do we do with this data? Some people argue, okay, yeah, there's more of these. However, there's more people today. And so, yeah, more people affected. Back in 1900, there was 2 billion people. Now we're at 7.5 billion. On the other hand, some of this data shows that it's not just the people affected, it is the events themselves, the natural disasters themselves, isn't it? Richard Heinberg says, yes, but there's more documentation today, which is a fair critique. Back in 1900, I wonder how much they were tracking some of these natural disasters. Today, we can't miss them. These are being documented like crazy. That's fair. One thing I'll say, though, it's definitely not getting better, okay, however you measure it. Whatever you look at with regard to this data, it's definitely getting worse. So it could be consistent that it's not really that bad, but it's at least consistent with Jesus' teaching all the same. What does Jesus refer to with these wars, rumors of wars, famines, and earthquakes? He says, but all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. birth pangs. Eventually, when you or your loved one has a baby, right before that baby's about to pop, they have these birth pangs, birth pains, labor pains. And one of the things you know when a woman is pregnant is that these become greater both in intensity, that is, the labor pains hurt more, and in frequency. When you start to get your labor pains, you feel the first one come on. I'm talking like I know. My wife knows. The first one comes on and you feel it. Ooh, man, that hurts. And then you're supposed to track. You're supposed to get out the watch. Okay, that was at 11:59. The next one comes, 12:15. Okay, those are 16 minutes apart. And then those labor pains are going to become from 16 minutes apart to 14, to 12, to 11, to 10. And as they start to become more intense, the pain, and with greater frequency, you know that baby's going to pop. And so this is the language Jesus uses to describe the coming of the end of human history. Earthquakes, famines, wars, worse in intensity and frequency. These are subjective to a certain degree, and yet these are preconditions. There are preconditions which are more objective, we should say. So the intensity of war, the intensity of earthquakes, the intensity of disease, I mean, there's a subjective level, there's a critique, sure, I would agree with that. But there's other objective preconditions which Jesus is going to address. He says then, after these wind-ups in preconditions, he says, then they will deliver you to tribulation. Now, he doesn't say this is the tribulation. Could be, like the great tribulation. But he says they will kill you. You will be hated by all nations because of my name. At that time, many will fall away, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. Because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. Is this a precondition? I mean, it's subjective if it is. He's winding up to the real objective stuff. Lawlessness being increased. Let's flip over to 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. Paul says to Timothy, he says, in the last days, difficult times will come. He says, people will become lovers of self, lovers of money, without self-control, haters of the good, lovers of pleasure. I mean, I don't know. Are we reading into this too much? Lovers of self? Have we ever seen a culture which is so autonomous, so individualistic? Maybe I'm being too ethnocentric. Like, I'm looking at this through the lens of modern-day America. I wonder if a Chinese believer or an African believer or a Haitian believer would feel the same way. On the other hand, I do think this is a global epidemic. People are growing more self-focused, more individualistic, more materialistic, you could argue. Globalization, the spread of capitalism, which in many ways is a great thing, and yet it's had this adverse effect that you can see people in the third world who have iPhones. What's that about? What are they doing with those? Without self-control, haters of good. Getting to the point where God calls something good and humans actually call that evil. They hate that. They hate what God calls good. Lovers of pleasure, addicted to pleasure. That could be referring to a moral decline, but the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. This gospel of the kingdom, Jesus says, shall be preached to the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. What does Jesus mean by all the nations? It's the same word, ethnos, ethnoi, ethnosin in this context. Go make disciples of all nations. When he means all nations, he doesn't mean the Roman Empire. Whatever he means has to be consistent with the Great Commission, Matthew 28. And so Jesus says, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world. That's like the whole planet. All nations. We're supposed to reach every person, tribe, tongue, and people. And then the end will come. So the end won't come until this occurs. Well, that would have been a pretty audacious claim to make. This is a week before Jesus is strung up and butchered like an animal. Most of his disciples have left him at this point. Read the end of John chapter 6. He's down to about a dozen. Even one of them betrays him. And he's saying, this good news I'm announcing, this is going to reach planet Earth. And then the end of the world is going to come. A Palestinian Jewish preacher, an itinerant rabbi, his message, that one message is going to reach everybody. Today, we see that this is coming to fruition. 2.18 billion Christians exist across the world, according to a recent Pew Research study. No single continent or region can indisputably claim to be the center of global Christianity. That's interesting. Think about 1910. Christianity was largely centered in Europe and in the Americas. So 66% of all Christians were in Europe. 27% were in the Americas. That's pretty much everybody. This was an American, European religion. Now in 2010, we see that only 25% of Christianity is European, 36% is American, 13% is Asian in the Pacific, and about a quarter, almost more than Europe, is sub-Saharan African. Now, this is a secular study. If we were to look at these as the real believing churches, like the ones that really believe in the Bible, believe in the gospel, the African churches would way outpace the European churches, the ones that actually believe in Scripture. And I would even argue the Church of China, which is predicted to outstrip the United States population of Christians in the next 10 to 20 years, is just booming. Authorities say anywhere between 10 to 30,000 Chinese come to Christ per day. One authority I read said 10,000. Another authority, which is actually more reliable, somebody who's actually in the Chinese house church movement, put it at 30,000. We don't know. It's spreading like wildfire. Sub-Saharan Africa had a roughly 60-fold increase, 9 million Christians in 1910 to more than 516 million Christians in 2010. That's a half a billion people, half a billion Christians. The Asia-Pacific region had a roughly 10-fold increase, 28 million Christians in 1910 to more than 285 million Christians in 2010. When the Boxer Rebellion happened in China, they kicked out all of the Western missionaries from China. We don't want you. We don't want Christianity. This is a communist republic. They got an atheistic worldview, dialectic, kicked out all the Christians. And, you know, Christians were lamenting, dear Lord, what's going to happen to the Chinese? Well, what happened to the Chinese was those Chinese who were discipled others, and this became a Chinese grassroots movement. And it spread like crazy. That's a tenfold increase in 100 years. Bill and Amy Stearns, this is from their book 2020 Vision. In 1950, there were 1 million believers in China. Today, conservative estimates say there are well over 80 million believers. An average of 28,000 people come to Christ every day in China. Yeah, they're putting in 28,000. I've read 10. I've read 30. This is happening. We're witnessing this happening. Now, Revelation 14 says that an angel during the tribulation is flying through the mid-heaven preaching an eternal gospel. It's also possible that angels finish the job on this. Before the end comes, that could be the case. Or it could be that we got to wait until we do the job here on earth. I don't know. Let's jump into verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. I love that verse. So many interpreters don't understand what he's saying here. Let the reader understand, spoken of through Daniel, standing in the holy abomination of desolation, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. So you're going to see this abomination. Which one? The one spoken of by Daniel. Where? Daniel 9. Can't refer to the one in 11. Can't refer to the one in 8. Got to be Daniel 9. And Jesus says this is future, future still. Let the reader understand, standing in the holy place. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. In Mark's version, Mark chapter 13, verse 14, I believe. Mark uses the masculine participle, hestakota, to refer to standing. The masculine participle implies a masculine subject. So a way of thinking about this, if you read the ESV, they capture this in translation. He who is standing in the holy place. Oh, 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 oh. How about that? So, Daniel 9:27, which amillennials say refers to Jesus, remember? They think the first part is Jesus and Daniel 9:27 is Jesus. He's the one that put an end to sacrifices. He's the one that judged the city and the temple and the sanctuary. They think that's all, they think all of Daniel 9 is Jesus, not the first part. They think the abomination of desolation in Daniel 9:27. That's Jesus. He's getting rid of the temple through judgment. Mark's version has the masculine participle here. He's saying standing in the holy place. Wait a minute. So we're saying that Jesus is the one who performed the abomination of desolation? Wait, wait, wait. 2 Thess 2:3. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first, and the man of lawlessness, i.e. not Jesus, is revealed, the son of destruction. Who's that? Whoever it is, not Jesus, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, Daniel 9:27, standing in the holy place, the temple, this man of lawlessness, where is he standing? In the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Paul, Jesus, and Daniel, if we're being consistent, lining up to this event, they place the Antichrist in the temple, performing the abomination of desolation. Not Jesus. And if that's true, if our reading of Daniel 9 is true, if we got the first part right, which I'm very convinced, Daniel 9:24-26. If we got that part right, and our second part is right, that would bring us with a 7-year tribulation. That would mean that the Antichrist is in the temple, not Jesus. That would mean, I mean, this would be a lock. This would be an absolute lock. And I believe it is. Read it and weep. Jesus was not performing the abomination of desolation. Then Paul says, don't you remember that when I was with you, I was telling you these things? No, we weren't there, Paul. Why don't you tell us more? Why so enigmatic? And you know what restrains him now, so that in his time he will be revealed. Yeah, the what here? What? What restrains him now? The man of lawlessness, the beast, the Antichrist, the son of destruction, whatever you want to call him. What? The what is neutered. So it's like an it. What restrains him now? For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. This is masculine, a masculine pronoun. So first it's, you know what restrains him. Then the second one is he restrains him. What do you think this refers to? Some people, a lot of interpreters throughout church history said this was the Roman government. Some people believed the he here is Satan. Satan, that's kind of cool. Holding back the Antichrist because he doesn't want to blow the timing. He's got a man, he's holding him back. That doesn't seem to fit. If you say it's the church, a lot of people say it's the church, and so this would be consistent with like a pre-tribulation rapture. If the church is taken out of the way, then why does it call the church a he and then call the church a what? A neutered what? An it and a he. Why the change in pronoun? Or it could be the Holy Spirit, the Holy Spirit is spoken of as a he, a person, not an it, who is within the church. That's my view. That would explain the pronoun shift. This would be consistent with the idea that the church in some way existing on earth is restraining this event from happening. And yet, you know what restrains him? The church. And yet he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way. At this point, the Holy Spirit leaves with the believers who are indwelt with the Holy Spirit. Now, critics of my view would say, is he saying the Holy Spirit doesn't exist on earth during the tribulation? Answer, well, did he exist before the church? Of course. Of course he existed. But he didn't indwell believers before the church. I believe the same thing's going to happen during this period called the Great Tribulation. That, yeah, the Holy Spirit will be operative, he will be working, yet he won't be working in the same way. Then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. So Jesus Christ is going to waste this guy here. Again, I got to take a pot shot at the preterists. How do they interpret this? They think the Antichrist was Nero or something like that. So Jesus slay Nero with the breath of his mouth. That's what happened. Nero, do you know how Nero died? He shoved a dagger into his throat. Jesus slay him with the breath of his mouth. Can't you see that? No, he committed suicide. So that doesn't fit. This has got to be future. Jesus coming back. That is the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders. So the Antichrist, son of destruction, man of lawlessness, the beast, whatever you want to call him, this figure, empowered by Satan, he performs signs and wonders and with power, dunamis, signs. These are all words used of Jesus' ministry. That's why they call him the Antichrist. And with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved. Anyways, he says God gave them a deluding influence so that they would not be saved. It only works on those who don't believe the truth. So I apparently forgot to put those in there. But just so you know, God sends some kind of an influence. What does that mean? Like God is like forcing people to not believe? No, because he says they did not believe the truth. It only works on somebody who would deny the God of the Bible. So we read here, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. So again, this would fit. This hasn't happened. This is future. But notice all the language here. I've made the case this is future. If this is referring to 70, then Jesus blew it. Because he's saying, wait till you see the abomination of desolation. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, right? Get out when you see this. At this point, they were all dead, right? So this has to be future. And yet notice something here. He's talking about Judea. If this is referring to the second coming, he's making this second coming return, end of history, tribulation event. He's saying it's Jewish. It's a Jewish event. It's not just that it's the church or something like that. It's in Judea. Whoever is on the housetop mustn't go down to get the things out that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. I mean, this is like, grab your kids, grab your wife, get out as fast as possible, right? But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. Oh, this is so similar to Luke in many ways, and yet so dissimilar, isn't it? Premillennialists, dispensationalists would say that this is an example of a type gap, where the destruction and judgment of Jerusalem in AD 70 is a type of a greater, more horrific judgment in the future. Similar language is used, and yet it's clear Matthew is referring to the future. Again, if I'm right about this, if the preterists are wrong, if what they're saying, oh, this is all fulfilled in AD 70, and we're saying, no, that does not fit, but pray that your flight will not be in the winter or on a Sabbath. Why does Jesus keep referring to Jewish themes? I mean, if this was fulfilled in AD 70, that would make sense, right? But if this is referring to the end of history, why does he keep mentioning Judea? Why is he mentioning the Sabbath? Isn't Christ Lord of the Sabbath? Isn't that done? Unless this tribulation period is going back to a Jewish construct. We read in verse 21, for then there will be a great tribulation. Oh, this is definitely end of history, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will, unless those days had been cut short. No life would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then, if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, don't believe him, For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. We read about this in 1 Timothy 4:1. In latter days, some will fall away from the faith. How? Paying attention to deceitful spirits and the doctrines of demons. How does Paul put it in 2 Thess? It will not come unless the apostasy comes first. What did we argue last week? That one of the keys that we're getting this right is correlation. You've got 2 Thessalonians saying it. You've got 1 Timothy saying it. You've got 2 Timothy 3 saying it. You've got Jesus saying it. Daniel 9. We're lining all these things up and we're seeing this is a lock. This is talking about the same thing. Take it or leave it. Behold, Jesus says, verse 25, I have told you everything in advance. So if they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. Or behold, he is in the inner rooms. Do not believe them. What's he saying? Like, oh, no, Christ, he came back. He's in the wilderness. He's like, no, don't ever wonder that I came back and I'm out in the wilderness with David Koresh, okay? Behold, he is in the inner rooms. Like, no, he was just over at my house. No, don't believe them. Why? He says, for just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes across the sky to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. When this happens, there will be no mistaking. You won't be wondering, oh, I wonder if he's out there in the field, or I wonder if he's over here, over there. Jesus is like, when I come back, it's going to be like, right across the sky, light it up. Holy cow, there he is. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. It's got to be one of the most hardcore sayings in the whole Bible. If I was a biker, I'd get that tattooed on my arm. Where the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. What's this talking about here? When Jesus comes back, it's not going to be like the first coming. It's not going to be where they make fun of him and they blindfold him and they spit in his face and they spin him around and squeeze a crown of thorns into his head and mock him and beat him and torture him and put him up on a cross. When Jesus comes back, he's not going to take judgment. He's going to give judgment. He's going to come in on a big white horse. He's going to come in with this whole posse of believers and angels. He's going to come in, he's going to take over, and he's going to judge the earth. And so when we read in Revelation 19 that John talks to the angels, he talks to the birds. He says, birds, gather, for the judgment of the Lamb has come. Feast on the flesh of kings and the flesh of generals and the flesh of men, small and great, large and small. It's just like, come and feast. I think that's lining up here where the corpse is. There the vultures, the feast of the birds to feed on these dead bodies. Pretty macabre, but there it is. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky. And the powers of the heavens will be shaken. This is going to be is there apocalyptic language being used there? He can't be referring to literal stars. Revelation refers to stars as angels. Whatever this is, remember we talked about symbolism? Like, okay, he could be using symbols, but it's symbolic of what? Symbolic of something cataclysmic happening. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. What is this about here? So he's going to come back. This is, unless he intervened, no life on earth would have been saved, right? So the nukes are in the air. War is reaching its absolute peak. Jesus comes back in, like lightning from the east to the west. Judges, the vultures show up. Judges, what's this part? Why does he need angels to go around and collect the elect? This must be that these people, these believers, everyone's judged. The tribulation has just happened, 7 years. A bloodshed, tyranny, the worst ruler the world has ever seen, the Antichrist. And there's believers all over the earth, four winds of the earth, that are bruised, bleeding, tortured, on the brink of death. And Jesus sends out angels all over the world, like a sky lift, air lift, to bring them back to get patched up. And then they go limping into the millennium that he sets up. Now, learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branches have already become tender and they put forth their leaves, you know that summer is near. What's this talking about? A fig tree, when the branches are starting to sprout, you know, okay, it's almost time for summer. So too, when you see all these things, recognize he is near. He's right at the door. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So what's he talking about here? What does the preterist say for this? Do you remember? The preterist says this generation refers to this generation, the generation to whom Jesus is speaking, the disciples, AD 70. It's not going to pass away until all these things take place. Preterist Gary DeMar says this, if you heard Jesus say that all these things would happen to, quote, this generation, and in every other instance of its use, this generation meant the present generation, and you also heard him speak of you will see these things, what would you conclude? That's a good point. Well, let's think about that for a second. So you too, Jesus uses the word you, plural, not always to refer to his contemporary audience. Yeah, DeMar says, oh, it always is used this way. No, it isn't. Just a chapter before, Matthew 23:35, Jesus is ripping apart the religious leaders. And what does he say? He says, upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from Abel, Genesis 4, to the blood of Zechariah, 2 Chronicles 24. When we're talking about history of thousands of years, whom you murdered. Wait a minute. Is Jesus really saying that these men and his audience murdered Abel, murdered all these prophets, murdered Zechariah? Is that what he's saying? He lived 400 years earlier? No, of course not. Don't be so dense. He's saying it's like people like you. You doesn't always mean you. Or Matthew 23:35, look, your house is left to you desolate, for I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. If a preterist says that the you here refers to Jesus' contemporary audience, they are stuck with the incredible, specious idea that they were singing the praises of God, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, as the Romans were burning them alive in AD 70. That has to be the most absurd, butchered reading of that. No way. So on the alternative, if the you here is referring to a future generation, that would be perfectly consistent here. Let's think about this. When you see all these things would be parallel in verse 33 with verse 34. All these things will take place, or the parable of the fig tree. When you see the figs sprouting, then you know this is the last generation. This generation that sees what? All these things. Then you will know. That's it. It's almost over. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. So much for the idea that we can predict the return of Jesus' coming. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark. Huh. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. I've heard some dispensational interpreters use this passage to imply that we're going to have moral depravity. It'll be like the days of Noah. I wonder if that's the right take here. When he says those days, obviously the days of Noah were nasty, but what's the analogy Jesus is making here? He's making the analogy that they were going on with life. They were eating and drinking. There's nothing immoral about that. Marrying and giving in marriage. Nothing immoral about that. Until the day Noah entered the ark. It's that they didn't understand until the flood came. So that picture that Noah is the crazy one, building an ark in the middle of a desert, a big barge, a huge barge, must have taken decades to build. And all the neighbors, they're eating and drinking. I mean, it was a morally abhorrent society in which he lived. And they're looking at him thinking, God, that's got to be the stupidest guy ever. Why would you build a barge, a cruise ship, a cruise liner in the middle of a desert? And yet they said that right up until the floodwaters came. And all of a sudden it was like, actually, he was in the right after all. And Jesus says, the same thing is true with my teaching. People are going to be looking at this, 2 Peter chapter 3. When is his coming? It's all been the same since the beginning of the ages until now. And yet they fail to realize that this actually is going to go down. This is going to happen precisely as Jesus predicted. He says in verse 40, then there will be two men in the field. One will be taken. One will be left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken. One will be left. Some dispensational interpreters take this to refer to the rapture. What do you think? One's taken, one's left. One's left behind. Okay, in this picture, you don't want to be the one taken. You want to be the one left behind. The context here is Noah's day. Right? Who are the ones taken? The ones taken for judgment. If you're left behind, that means you're going to make it into the millennial kingdom. Therefore, be on the alert, for you don't know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. Yeah, wouldn't you just love, especially you guys who just had your houses broken into in the last couple months, wouldn't you have loved to just be on top of the roof, ready for that burglar coming in, just like, oh, I can't wait to get my hands on this guy here. Yeah, Jesus is saying that's why thieves don't call ahead. Thieves always come precisely when you don't know they're going to show up. I don't know if you've ever had that happen. Have a thief come in, rob all your stuff. That sickening feeling. You know, I just was not expecting that to happen today. I got home. Where's all your stuff? Gone. Huh, I woke up. I just did not think I'd have all my stuff stolen tonight. There it is. Only the analogy breaks down because it's a thief is a bad guy. Jesus is the good guy. The sickening feeling is not going to be on the behalf of believers, but on those who refused the forgiveness of Christ. For this reason, Jesus says, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think that he will. And so, what have we seen so far? That Jesus would die in AD 33. We saw that fulfilled. That Israel would be regathered as a nation. We've seen that fulfilled. The Roman Empire would be reunited, to a large degree, fulfilled. The European Empire is a thing. They're in with one another. That we would have technology to control buying and selling, control universal commerce, something which has never happened, never happened in the first century, hasn't happened in the 19th century since. We've got that. What about a population big enough to support a 200 million person army? That has never been the case up until the last several decades. What about a one world government? We don't have that, but we could be moving in that direction. A lot of people are calling for this. Political scientists say it's a matter of time. When everyone's hands are in each other's pockets, fiscally speaking, we're all connected economically. It's just a matter of time before we become connected politically. And we are definitely connected economically. A lot of political scientists will say, we'll never go to war with China. We're making too much money off of each other. They're going to work something out. And so this idea that you follow the money, where the money goes, the politics catch up with it. To be in a situation, to see a war that could end all life on earth, again, kinda. We haven't seen it yet. We could. We definitely could. We saw that if even less than 1% of the nuclear arms were exchanged between India and Pakistan that would create a global famine, a global crisis. And so, yeah, we could be. And I guess what's the point here? That we're seeing each one of these predictions coming to fruition, and we're in a situation today where this is lining up. So if the first installation has come to fruition, that must mean the parts that haven't been fulfilled yet will also come to fruition.